It's time for the one show that takes you where no one else will, out into the wilderness of sales techniques and technologies, with your own personal guide through this new world. And here he is, the international sales trainer, Will Crist.
Well, hello. We are talking today with some interesting people. You know, when we think about businesses in Orange County and Southern California, very often we get talking around entrepreneurial, new ideas, new inventions. We've done a lot of interviews with people who are bringing new things to the table. We've talked to people who are generating products that are going to take sunlight, ambient light, and put it into our cell phones. We've talked to Metal Mobile, who is creating apps for the iPhone and now for the iPad. We've talked to lots of people around who are startups, who are entrepreneurial and experienced and looking to grow their business. We've also talked to people who've been around for a while. And these have been businesses that have gone through the ups and the downs of the recent late unpleasantness, as some people like to talk about it. But one of the things that's been really intriguing to me is listening to people who have been, their businesses have been around for a long time. We're going to have a couple of people, one today and one in the next couple of weeks. Companies that have been around since the 30s. This is the second and the third generation who are running the company now. So they've honed their processes, and they are movers and shakers around the country in terms of their industry. So I'm very, very interested in, and I'm delighted to bring onto the show Frank Grinke from SC Fuels, nominated by ACG for one of the top awards. Frank is in Hawaii right now. So, Frank, welcome to Pilgrim Talks.
Yeah, thanks so much. Glad to be here.
Well, Frank, tell us a little bit about SC Fuels.
Well, we've been around since 1930, and in my family since 1965, and I became the third owner in 1995 when I acquired it from my parents. And we're a petroleum transportation fuels distribution company operating in roughly 20 states in the western United States.
That kind of growth didn't come just from the skies, naturally.
I'm sorry?
That kind of growth didn't just come organically. You had to have a plan for that.
Yeah, no, that's correct. I was fortunate enough to belong to a group called Young Presidents Organization in the early 1990s, and from that peer group exchange, we started an outside advisory board to try and bring some discipline into what had been the kitchen table environment, and we also put in a strategic plan process that's really facilitated the growth we've experienced in the last 17 or 18 years.
And because of that, you've had this, what some would say, phenomenal growth in an industry that is highly competitive.
It's pretty darn competitive, that's for sure, and we have enjoyed growth. There has been a consolidation that's gone on within our segment of the industry, and we've taken advantage of that to add a number of companies to our family through acquisition in addition to our organic growth process.
And tell me a little bit about what exactly SC Fuels does.
Well, we do a number of different things, but it's all within the distribution process. We sell to branded gasoline stations, for example. In fact, I'm here in Hawaii on an incentive trip with Shell Oil Company, where we recently purchased a number of Shell gasoline stations that we then put dealers in place. So we'll purchase the product from Shell over a long-term period and then distribute it to the gas stations. We also have a wholesale and trading division that would purchase products in large bulk amounts, 25 to 100,000 barrels at a time, and then break them down at smaller amounts and distribute those to large high-volume resellers, Albertsons or Costco or Sam's Club. And then we also have a company that has card locks, actually. My dad invented the first card lock in the United States in 1972, and that would be somewhat like an ATM, but dispenses petroleum products unattended to commercial vehicles. And we operate a number of those in several states. We are in lubricants. We sell lubricants for end users, primarily heavy-duty motor oil end users and passenger car motor oil. And in the Northwest, we're involved in heating oil. We are probably the largest home heating oil distributor up in the Pacific Northwest. And then we also have another division that handles mobile refueling, where we would go to a fleet of a company that would have a fleet of trucks, and we would service them at night to deliver the fuel to them.
So you're really in the delivery business, providing people with efficiency and what would you call it? You're making it possible for them. They don't have to hire people themselves. They don't have to drive down someplace to get it. You're providing it for them.
That's one segment. On the other hand, what I mentioned are card locks, features the best service in the world, self-service, where the people with companies with fleets have their drivers come to our facilities and fuel themselves because it's they don't have to have tanks inside their own facilities. They don't have the environmental hazards of having dozens and dozens of different tanks around. And we would normally locate these things inside industrial areas where there normally wouldn't be a traditional fueling facility like a gas station or a truck stop.
So the card lock really stands in lieu of a filling station.
That's correct, but with the exception being it's for commercial vehicles only and typically located in a place that you wouldn't find a traditional gas station.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, so a couple of questions I have for you. Talk to me a little bit. Help us to understand what is all this concern around peak oil and end of oil products and gasoline and all of that. You're at the heart of the industry. Help us to get some sanity around that.
Well, I'll do the best I can, understanding that even I get such a variety of different numbers on when peak oil is to occur. Now, it seems like every time oil gets expensive, like it is right now, there's all of a sudden a whole bunch more available because the cost allows exploration that was normally too expensive to be accomplished. For example, some of the stuff deep water in the Gulf of Mexico or the tar sands in Canada. So, I'm not sure I can answer it, but we've heard a variety of different years from 50 to 250 years. So that's the best I can do for you.
So I shouldn't probably be thinking the car that I'm driving right now is that I'm going to see the last tank of gas in its lifetime.
Well, a couple things I'd give you. It took us 30 years nationally to take the lead out of gasoline. And that was using the existing infrastructure to try and move to a different product like a hydrogen or electricity or some other form of energy. The infrastructure is not there to support that. When we moved from MTBE, a chemical that was an environmental additive, to ethanol, for example, because MTBE caused a problem when tanks would leak underwater with the into the underground water system, that caused huge disruptions across the United States because ethanol can't be shipped through pipeline, which is the way we move most of our products over long distances. So the infrastructure itself said it's going to be quite difficult for us to move to a different product anytime soon. And I'd also add that I think that our average fleet turnover in the United States, the amount of time it takes us to, if you start right now, it's about 15 years. So, I've got a three-year-old grandson, and I've said for some time I think he'll be driving a gasoline car.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. So talk to us about prices. What's going on right now with prices? Why are they so high? How long are they going to be there? What's your best guess?
Well, the best cure for low prices are low prices, and the best cure for high prices are high prices. And so we've seen the price drop quite a bit in the last week and a half or 2 weeks, although it's up again today. I'd say, at least on the West Coast, the prices are largely driven by the NYMEX, which is largely driven by non-petroleum resellers, by investors that are speculating on the price of oil, as well as all other commodities. So I think it's probably a pretty good bet we'll see them retreat to where we don't know, but I think gold and silver and corn and oil have enjoyed historic highs just recently without having really big demand behind them. I think we've been building inventories in oil inside the United States while price has gone up. So I think once the speculators move on to a different type of investment, we'll see some normalcy where hopefully it gets back to a demand and supply equation.
Now, tell me a little bit about what that means for you and your business. How do you go about acquiring? Do you have long-term contracts that are fixed? Are you on the market all the time? Do you have people who are looking around for available supplies? How does your business work?
We don't have long-term contracts that are fixed, and that the amount of volatility in the business makes that kind of a gamble way too high. We've seen recently daily product movements of 30 cents a gallon. any type of volume you could move, that type of volatility, if you were to guess one way or the other, it's too much of a gamble. So our contracts would typically be 30 days or less, and quite often it's day-to-day. You pick it up that day, and you sell it in hours, and hopefully you have enough of that ability to control the volatility that it's not too speculative for you.
All right. So what's been the effect of the recent perturbation in the marketplace for you, the economy and all that? How's that affected your company?
Well, a couple different ways. One, the high prices aren't really good for anybody in the industry other than maybe the oil producers. The cost to do business, you know, is much more to do the same amount of volume. And in our industry, we operate on unit margins, not as a percentage of sales. So for us, ideal conditions would be high volatility at really low prices. And the exact opposite occurred. And we've had some volatility, but with really high prices. So the cost of inventory, of bad debt, of accounts receivable have been much higher. And the margin really hasn't changed so much. So we look forward to a period where that's gotten, that will come down a bit more. And on top of that, I think that we'll see, we're experiencing now, but not really documented yet, but demand destruction from the high prices. You take a look at, you know, the last time prices went over $4 a gallon, the average fill-up for your SUV wasn't $40, it's now $80. So that extra $40 that used to go to be able to go down to the local store and buy sheets or whatever product would be, you don't do that anymore. So the truck driver doesn't need to deliver the sheets to the store, which means the truck doesn't go to the truck stop and buy fuel, and it's just a whole spiral that is really unhealthy for the economy. So I think we're all looking forward to lower prices.
Now, that money doesn't come to you, does it, that high price?
No, it doesn't. As I explained earlier, our margin is per unit, per gallon, and so it's not affected. It's not like most of the world, the retail world, works on profit as a percentage of sales. For some reason, we've not adopted that in our segment of the industry. So higher prices mean higher expenses and not higher margins.
Now, then, where does that money go? Does that go to the oil company, or does that get stopped by the speculators? Where would you say that money's going?
Well, it would go to the oil producers, and under the companies like we've seen historic profits with Shell or ExxonMobil or Chevron, because they're making money off the production. There is a margin within the refinery operation, and that has been up, although that's typically not been a great business, and why many companies have decided to shed that. It doesn't pass down into the retail, and I think the recent number has been that the major oil companies only operate 3% of the retail stations in the United States. The rest are operated largely either by companies like ours or, in our case, where we supply, they're first-generation Americans that own one or two or six stations.
Wow. So there are a lot of individually owned stations in the country.
The majority of them are small entrepreneurs that operate just a few stations. And like I said, many of them, this is they're the first generation to come to America from the Middle East, from Asia, and they're here just living the American dream in a small way.
And a lot of these stations, now the stations that you have, are they all, do they all have food components to it?
You know, none of the stations we direct operate have food. As I mentioned, we call them card locks, and what they are strictly for commercial vehicles, and they're operated or located normally inside industrial areas where we just want them to come in and get their fuel, and as their owners to want their trucks to get their fuel and get out and get on with their business. So we do supply a number of traditional gas stations that would have operate in the retail area and have convenience stores, but we do not direct operate any ourselves.
Okay. All right. Well, now, your family has been around Orange County for a long time. Tell us a little bit about what you've seen in Orange County, what you've seen in Southern California. What have you seen that's changed?
Well, it's been an amazing thing. Both my families, of course, came from Europe, my mom's family and my dad's family, and they both stopped in Chicago along the way, and I was fortunate they continued on and went to Southern California. And my dad was a truck driver for then was Standard of Cal, now Chevron, and just tried to live the American dream and bought a small little consignee ship in Tustin in 1965. And we moved down there. Tustin had 14,000 residents and one gas station. It was largely an agrarian society, which is what we did. We supplied the Irvine Ranch and other farmers their petroleum products. And then, you know, in the late 60s and early 70s, Orange County started to convert into being a suburb of Los Angeles, where we had more commercial and industrial accounts. And so I've seen the where there used to be a separation between driving to the big city of L.A. from Tustin, now where it's just one big population mass.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So we've seen the growth of Orange County. It's not just a suburb of L.A., is it? Do you see it as having its own culture apart from L.A.?
Yeah, without a question. I think that was what the big uproar was about, having Los Angeles Angels of Anaheim. So, yeah, Orange County's definitely different. I was born in downtown Los Angeles, but I'm definitely a product of growing up inside Orange County, and the culture and the demeanor is quite different than it is in L.A.
Now, you probably have business associates, maybe even competitors, from companies like yours up in L.A., correct?
That's correct, we do.
Do you notice any difference in the way that you do business and they do business?
Well, it depends. I mean, you know, because of the nature of the industry that we're in, we've been required to be successful to have a fair amount of geographic diversity. So competitors my size would have done the same thing. So we operate in 20 states. So it isn't just the difference between Orange County and L.A. It would be, I live in Southern California and I'm trying to do business in Washington, that has an anti-California sentiment as well. So our competitors, wherever they're based, would have the same type of, same type of things that would be affecting them.
Okay, all right. So, what kinds of things in Southern California would you point to that have helped your business to thrive?
Well, part of it, I guess, it's a good and a bad thing. I mean, California overall, and certainly Southern California, is on the forefront of regulation, and I guess for those companies that haven't been able to grow to a size where you can, you're able to distribute the cost of the regulations over a fair amount of units, in our case gallons, they normally couldn't survive. The other thing that it gives you is if you're able to live within that environment and you go to other states where they're developing those rules but really following California's process, you look like you're prescient in that you've been through it already and the people that are based in those areas haven't been through it. So it gives you a bit of leg up on how to deal with those regulations that are occurring. For example, we'll have to deal in California with a cap-and-trade law starting next year going through 2020. Probably going to be a national law. It hasn't happened yet, but we'll probably have, as we have with many things, experienced those things and what they do to the marketplace in advance.
So does that give you a competitive advantage?
I think it does in areas that are newer to the regulations in California. For example, we have what's called vapor recovery systems, where we retain the air that comes out of your tank when it's displaced by the gasoline that goes in it. California had that in 1973, and it was really expensive and drove a number of smaller businesses out of business. When that process went national, we'd already experienced the cost and the understanding of what it takes to have the maintenance on those operations, which was new to those areas where it came later.
Okay. All right. What are there other advantages that you find in Southern California for your business?
Well, that's a great question, because we're also faced with, you know, the tremendous amount of regulations that have driven so many businesses out of not just Southern California, but all of California. So I think the last several years has probably been a bit more of a disadvantage. The cost that we have of the taxation, the cost that we have of regulation, makes it easier for a business like in the state of Texas, for example, to have their headquarters there, because the cost of maintaining the operations is less there. So I'm born in California, and sworn in California. It's a disadvantage to be a California-based business now.
Mm. So talk a little bit about what would benefit your business. What sorts of changes would benefit your business?
Lower taxes.
Yeah, lower taxes.
Let us keep some of the money so we can create jobs with it. It would benefit just not our business, but I think the entire community.
Yeah, yeah. That seems to be a real big issue right now. I mean, it's, how do we create jobs, not only here, but all around the world, right? How do we create jobs for people who just don't have anything to do?
You know, I'm proud of what our company's been able to do. I addressed our company at our holiday party last December, and I said it was – a great debate going on about how we can extend the jobless benefits. And I said, you know, a year and a half ago that we were 350, and since that time we've grown to 500 employees, and most of that growth has come outside the state, unfortunately. But I said, we're not talking about jobless benefits. We're talking about creating jobs, creating benefits, and creating the best kind of welfare that is, that the people take care of themselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Some of the things that I've discovered in around the world in various places is that there is a tremendous sense of unrest, dis-ease, depression, listlessness, and leads to the kind of dependency when there's no jobs. And how we solve that problem, it's so interesting to me that we even talk about creating jobs. Now, that's not something we did 50 years ago thinking, did we? How do we create jobs?
No. I was just a wee lad 50 years ago.
Yes,
right. I don't recall during my career ever having the discussion of, you know, we have to focus on job creation like we have now. And the jobs created themselves, and it seems like the more we focus on job creation, the less jobs are created.
Yeah. I'm wondering if...
Let the money stay with us and watch what happens.
Yeah. And somewhere in there, there's a purpose. There's an intention. There's a desire to create, solve problems, create companies. And in doing that, a byproduct of that is job creation, right?
Yes, that's correct.
So... I'm just wondering, it's been on my mind for several years. How do we go about helping people to rediscover or discover a sense of purpose, a sense of opportunity out there that they can go forward? I mean, that's exactly the opposite of the entitlement mentality.
Well, I think we've had a systemic institutional failure in institutionalizing everyone, saying that the government's going to take care of us rather than we need to be self-reliant or self-independent. So by giving or abdicating our responsibilities to government, then we end up with these programs that just take people and take their drive to take care of themselves away.
Yeah.
And it's just a downward spiral.
Yeah. Yeah, it really does have to do with focusing on helping people find meaningful, not just meaningful employment, but meaningful occupation. And it might be entrepreneurial. It might be working in an existing company. It might be doing just about anything that accomplishes the purpose that I believe I'm here for.
Right.
And to my way of thinking, that doesn't mean that if somebody fails, that they're gonna fall all the way down to the bottom. I mean, that doesn't mean that we don't have some sort of safety net at some point. But it's really tricky. To maintain that kind, well, you've seen it, you know it, that kind of concern about making the payroll next week. You may not have it now, but you've had it sometime in your career, right?
Without a question, what a scary feeling that is. But once you've been there and you come back for it, from that, you say, I'm learning from this experience. And, I mean, the first and foremost of everything you need to do is make sure that the people are paid.
Yeah, and it's that sense of I can do it. I have a goal for that where I'm going. I can do that, and something about the entitlement mentality takes that risk away. I don't have that experience of having the risk and getting through it and winning, and then learning that I'm capable of taking care of what I need to be doing to get to my goal.
Yeah, that's correct. And, you know, hopefully one of the greater cultures we have within our company is that of empowerment, and that, you know, we have an agreement with someone that will do a job. We give them the jobs to do. We have rules of engagement on what's to be accomplished, and you step back and empower them to do their own thing to make their job work. And they're just the majority of the people given that chance thrive in that environment.
Yeah, we were talking about that in the management program today. There's something about a company culture that seeks to find somebody doing something right, and then makes a public show of that, even if it's just an attaboy or attagirl for risking and succeeding.
Well, certainly to celebrate success is a wonderful thing, and you take a look at our taxation structure, and certainly the proposed changes that are coming from Washington about trying to tax those that are successful, it's more of a culture of punishing success rather than empowering it. Those people that would create jobs through achievement of success are being punished for that.
Yeah, it sure can come across that way, can it? It's you know, the more I succeed, the more I wind up being a. How would you say it? The more I succeed, the more I become a.
Well, I offer this observation. We were the first company to do business in the former Soviet Republic of Georgia in the early 90s. So I was able to go through the experience of employing a number of people that had just come out of communism. And these poor folks just didn't know how to work. They didn't know the basic concepts that we have of self-reliance because they were totally state-supported. And I was able to see firsthand how that system worked. The government takes care of everything and then doesn't do that, doesn't work. So I'm a firm believer in our society saying stop, like, taking money from a donor state like California or a donor community like Orange County to Sacramento, taking the money over there and then sending back, you know, a partial amount of that back and say, well, we're here to help you. It doesn't work.
Mm-hmm. So you actually went to Georgia. Now, this is the Soviet Republic of Georgia. Not our Georgia.
Yeah, that's correct.
You actually went there, and do I understand that you helped people to learn how to be capitalists?
Yeah, we did. It was a fascinating thing. My dad has been quite a pioneering man, and miss him dearly. He's been passed for a few years now, but went there with the sole purpose of bringing capitalism, bringing an idea on how to be self-reliant to the people there. And we built their first Western-style U.S. gas station there in 1992.
We just have a little bit more time here, but I'm just, it's a profound idea that you have. I wonder what it would take to have that kind of idea and bring it to people in California who had lost that sense of ability to participate in capitalist world. I mean, go ahead.
Well, I think it takes an exhibition of what the changes that can occur, and I would offer Georgia as one. They went through the Rose Revolution roughly 8 years ago or so, and I was honored to have President Mikhail Saakashvili in my home a year ago in front of a number of prominent Orange County folks, and he stood up and talked about the experience of the change from the prior regime to his, and they lowered their top nominal tax rate from 60% down to 12% and increased their revenues 20-fold.
Hmm. Well, at the same time, they were empowering people.
Right.
And
people got to keep their money.
That, to me, is a critical piece. I mean, I just wonder if we fuzzed up our eyes a little bit and compared the Republic of Georgia to some of the parts in the United States that have lost that entrepreneurial gleam, that have lost that ability. If we could do here. In some places that need it, what you did there, I mean, it seems to me that would change this whole notion of entitlement and dependency.
Well, that's certainly been my experience.
Yeah. Well, that's something I'd like to talk more about sometime, Frank. Really appreciate your time and taking time away from, I'm sure it's a beautiful day there in Hawaii, and it's the middle of the afternoon, isn't it?
Yeah, yes, it is. Yeah, 3 hours earlier here, and it is a wonderful place to be.
Well, that's great. Do you hear the golf course calling you right now?
You know, I don't. I'm not a golfer, but certainly I'll be able to visit with some of the other marketers with the oil company that's brought us here, so I look forward to it.
Well, great. I look forward to talking to you with you more on your return, and congratulations on being nominated for that award with ACG.
Wonderful. I'm honored to be on your program. Thanks so much.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
And there's one of the real champions of free enterprise and empowerment and finding ways to help people not only here but also in places like the Republic of Georgia. That's astounding. That's powerful, very powerful. There's going to be a time when that kind of effort is going to pay off here in this country as people begin to discover that there's a lot more a lot more than just the fruits of entitlement. There are possibilities out there. There are purposes that they're called to be, and they can find great satisfaction doing that. But Frank is one of those people I really enjoy talking to. Before we hear another entrepreneur and long-term business owner, I want to hear a word from our sponsor, Sandler Training.
Hi, it's time for another tip from Sandler Training. Never ask for the order. Make the prospect give up. Always ask for the order is the salesperson's 11th commandment. You know, the one that just dropped right off the tablets. Never ask for the order goes completely against traditional selling methods. If you don't ask for the order, how will you ever know when the customer is going to buy? Well, think about it. The only person who can really ask for the order is the prospect. Find the prospect's emotional needs first. Provide the answers to meet these needs, and you'll discover that the prospect will give up and ask you for the order.
Probably not.
And that's another tip from Sandler Training, finding power through reinforcement.
And if you want to hear one of the ways that Sandler trainers reinforce the beliefs that salespeople can be what they believe, listen up. Here it is.
The Belief Song, courtesy of Sandler Training.
All the strength, all the courage, it's just me who cannot see. My mind is always listening to the things I do, to the things I say. Sometimes something's missing, 'cause I can when I think I can. I'm more than I think I am. Sleepwalking, never talking, not knowing where to begin. But no more, you can't talk into me. I said, wake up, I said, listen up, I can choose what I believe. 'Cause I can, when I think I can, I'm more. Damn. things I can when I think I can. I'm more than I think I am. I can when I think I can. I am. 'Cause I can when I think I can. I'm more.
And now back to Will Christ and his next guest.
And there we are. That's Stevenson Brooks from Sandler Trainer from Las Vegas. You know, we really fortunate to have some powerful people around who've built businesses and maintain those businesses and are growing those businesses by developing their people. I want to talk a little bit, like I mentioned last week, I want to begin to delve into customer service and what the role of customer service is in building business and providing services to our customers. And one of the people that I've asked to speak with us is the president, the founder, the owner of MBK Enterprises, Jeff Kaminsky. So, Jeff, welcome to Pilgrim Talks.
Thank you, Phil. Will. It's good to be here.
Now, tell us a little bit about MBK. Help orient us. What is it that you do?
Well, we actually changed our name to MBK Tape Solutions last year to better reflect some of what we do. And we fabricate pressure-sensitive adhesive parts and flexible materials into various components that go into all different types of industries around the world. A good example that most people could relate to maybe is when you buy a new cell phone and it has a screen protector on there that you peel off to use it. That would be an example of what we do. Or if you happen to go into the hospital and you have some tubes taped to you or some wound care dressings to keep things together, that would be another example of some of the products that we have to work with.
Yeah, now, you mentioned this morning we were looking at the Zagmet, and you mentioned, did you say that you were helping supply them with some of their components?
That is correct. A lot of the new phones, the smartphones, have touch screens on them. So what a lot of people are doing now is putting a protective cover on there. It's a more semi-permanent one so that you don't scratch the surface of that screen. And there have been some really neat materials developed in recent years that, you know, allow you to put it on, it protects the screen, you can see through it clearly, but if you ever have to remove it, you could do so without leaving a bunch of residue. So we're supplying that marketplace with several different products.
Now, are you an aggregator, a vendor, or are you in fact a manufacturer?
Well, we're more a manufacturer. We're actually known as a fabricator, but we're really manufacturing. We bring in materials from vendors like 3M, in large jumbo rolls and wind them down and slit them and then die cut them into different shapes. So that screen protector that's going on your iPhone, you know, starts out at a 54-inch wide log that gets slit down and then it gets die cut into, you know, the specific shape so it fits onto your iPhone properly.
Mm-hmm.
That make sense?
Yeah. Now, did you start this business?
My father actually started the business in 1973 and had basically a one-man shop going. He had been in the tape business for about 15 years. And I happened to start working for 3M when I got out of college in 77, and he passed away in 79, so I stepped in and have since built it up. And it's a lot of fun because we get to deal with, like I said, almost any type of industry around, and it's always changing, it's dynamic. You know, a lot of this stuff has gone offshore, and it was a little scary at first 10 years ago, but, you know, we've kind of developed our niche here. There's still quite a bit of manufacturing going on here in the United States, and, you know, there's a lot of people that don't want to wait, you know, 12 to 16 weeks to get a product made, and they don't want to have to buy a container load, so there's a lot of stuff happening here. There's a lot of opportunities for people here in Southern California and elsewhere, I think.
Spoken like a true entrepreneur.
Yes, sir.
Now, so talk to us a little bit about the role that customer service plays in your organization.
It's customer service is king. It's, you know, even though we're not selling a commodity, so there's other things that can differentiate us, but when you go to a store or, you know, you talk to a customer service rep online for something, customer service is king, and you're going to walk out of that experience feeling warm and fuzzy, or you're going to be frustrated typically. And I'm fortunate that the first person I hired for customer service in the late 80s, a woman, Sherry Doherty, she was of the mold that the customer comes first, and we have to take care of the customer, and you know, if we don't, somebody else is going to, and just adherence to the golden rule of, you know, trying to treat people the way you want to be treated. And that's pretty much guided us throughout, and I think it's created a successful environment, you know, within our organization and with our customers. You know, we do customer surveys periodically, and one key standout is the level of customer service that people get from our company.
So what have you done to foster, develop, increase, improve customer service for MBK?
Probably one of the first major things, other than, you know, just chit-chatting, but in a more organized fashion, about 15 years ago, everybody in customer service, we, you know, did an in-house customer service training. Back then it was on, you know, video cassette recorder. But, you know, it was an ongoing program about what makes good customer service. You know, if a customer needs something right away, and they're asking for it, we don't want to be telling them, well, the truck's not here. It should be, you know, let me see what I can do. How much do you need? What's going to get you out of a bind type of thing? Everything is, you know, geared towards helping the customer. And I think as we have moved forward with, you know, this ideology, the customer service reps that are in there are excited knowing that, you know, they're helping somebody out. And our customers are appreciative of it, and they're continually telling our customer service people and the salespeople, you know, what a great customer service department you have.
So the results have been a strong reputation.
Right.
What other results have you seen?
Well, just, you know, back on the original question, another aspect, thinking now, that probably helped develop a better, more thorough customer service is, you know, moving to the ISO standard, because mm-hmm. It sets a certain protocol in place for contract review and to make sure that you get the order right and that you're giving the customer what they want and in a time fashion that you can deliver on,
mm-hmm.
Which has helped move that along. The other thing our people do a lot of is that they're very proactive in their approach to things. You know, if, especially in today's market where we're experiencing shortages of, you know, base raw materials in the plastics industry, and we've seen off and on delays in deliveries, you know, even from people like 3M coming into our door. So when we, you know, send back a confirmation to one of our customers that we're going to deliver in 2 weeks, and then we get notice from our vendor that it, you know, it's delayed, our people don't just ship it when it comes in. They're proactive. They'll call the customer up and explain the situation, see if there's anything that we can do, you know, a partial or some such thing that might help them out of their bind so that their production lines don't go down. I think it's just being, you know, proactive and communicating well amongst themselves as well as with the customer. It just, you know, it's like positive energy that spreads versus
negative energy. So you get the positive energy. What do you do to encourage, to support, to further customer service efforts in your organization?
There's ongoing dialogue on a regular basis. The between customer service and the sales department and production, liaising with, you know, all three, and doing gap analysis. If there are, you know, for example, if there is a customer complaint, you know, we do a formal complaint. We try and analyze what the root cause was and, you know, what can we do to prevent that from happening again. And that's just an ongoing process of, you know, continual improvement or effort to continually improve on our part. So, you know, again, it's communication, I think, is, you know, a key factor. And, you know, trying to identify any areas of lapse. You know, another interesting thing that we do, we have four primary people in our customer service department.
Yes.
When we redid their offices, rather than sitting in isolated cubicles, they chose to sit in a more open pit, so to speak, because when they're in there dealing with customers, they can then, and this might sound a little goofy, but they can overhear conversations and customer names, and it kind of cues them in as to what's going on with a particular customer, especially if there's, you know, some sense of urgency to a situation or something. So that, you know, if the customer's talking to Peter and Peter's away from his desk and they call back and, you know, somebody else is not completely clueless as to, you know, what might be happening. So that kind of seemed to help.
Okay. What do you use, what sorts of tools do you use to track customer inquiries, customer problems, even customer complaints?
Well, inquiries, we have a formal inquiry form that's filled out either by the customer service rep or if it's a salesman that takes the initial call. That's filled out, and then it's put into our system. So anybody can look up into the system to see, you know, what might have been done to that point. And we do the same thing with customer complaints. There's a query form that, you know, logs the complaint and takes whatever information is available and starts that whole process. And that also is logged into the system so that anybody can look and find out what's going on with it.
So what's the system? What's the system that you use? Is it Salesforce.com or what?
We're not using any, you know, we're using the software that we have that manages the company as far as accounting and inventory and everything else is being utilized to track customer inquiries and complaints and all things like that. As far as sales, we don't have Salesforce or anything like that specifically from as a CRM or anything.
Okay. All right, so you have something that fits in with your accounting software, your organizational software that runs the company.
Exactly.
And right. Now, how often do you see those reports?
I see daily stuff as far as, well, there's the daily information that I'm looking at. There's a weekly report that produces, you know, inquiries, number of sales booked, average value of the sale, you know, what's been shipped that week, things like that. So it's a pretty clear picture of what's happening, especially, you know, from a sales standpoint. I could see how much we've sold that week, or, you know, are bookings leading the sales, or is it the opposite way? If it's the opposite way, it makes me a little nervous. But but overall, business has been good. So
good. Now, so do you get regular reports about the customer complaints, customer issues, and their resolution?
We do, and then as part of management, we have a ISO management committee. So that typically meets monthly, and that's part of that process to discuss customer complaints, to see, you know, we try and measure what's going on. What area of the company did the complaint stem from, or, you know, was the root cause, was it a customer service issue, you know, failure to contract review properly, was it a manufacturing problem, things like that. So we try and measure that type of information and then see if there's any trending going one way or another. Because if there is, then, you know, we want to take a closer look at it.
So you've done training for customer service. You do monitoring, and you allowed your customer service people to design their workspace.
Correct.
Hmm. Who manages the customer service team?
We all wonder that right now. It's they are fairly autonomous right now. They're pretty much self-empowered. There's not. There's more. There'll be dialogue if issues come up, but there's not like a day-to-day supervision per se.
Mm-hmm.
They're working more as a self-empowered team,
mm-hmm.
which is working highly effectively. Mm-hmm. And then we have, you know, like I said, there's dialogue. You know, as a company, we have a weekly staff meeting, you know, management meeting, so to speak. And mm-hmm. if there are any issues that somebody wants to bring to the table, we can discuss them then. Mm-hmm. But most of the stuff we seem to be able to work out as customer service liaises with production or sales. The communication level has come to, you know, a pretty good point where they seem to be able to work things out themselves without the, you know, interference or the need for help from somebody from above.
So,
and I think that feeling of self-empowerment, you know, helps build the esprit de corps as well.
Okay. And are they aware that that's a good thing that they're doing with each other?
I think so. I think they're very proud of themselves.
Okay. Okay, good.
I think they're excited to be there every day.
Right. That's excellent. Now, what sorts of rewards do you give them?
They're on a, obviously a salary, but then they're on, they get a monthly spiff on business written and new business written.
Mm-hmm.
To sort of incentivize them. And then, you know, periodically there's a random bonus from nowhere just because mm-hmm. they've done such an outstanding job, kind of mm-hmm. like a little gift from heaven, mm-hmm. so to speak.
Now, when you say spiff, is that like, are you saying that's like a small commission?
Yeah, it's a percentage of sales. Uh-huh.
Right.
Exactly.
So it is, they are incentivized by a commission.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Okay.
That is correct.
Good.
Uh-huh.
Good.
Yeah.
Now,
so as they see, and they put the numbers up on the board too. I mean, you should see them, you know, towards the end of the month, the last few days of the month, and they themselves are looking at, you know, oh, what are we going to be able to ship in the next few days? And are we going to meet our goal? And they're always setting the goal on this board, you know, at least 10% above, you know, what we did the previous period. So,
wow. Well, that's exciting. Congratulations. You're doing a good job there. I mean, to be able to create that kind of esprit de corps for that small group of people, that's to be commended. Good job.
Well, thank you. It's challenging, you know, because small companies, like any size company, is, you know, people talk. You get somebody who gets a feather ruffled for whatever reason, it can bring down the spirit rapidly, so.
Mm-hmm. Well, so that brings me to a question I wanted to ask. For other business owners who are looking at customer service, what are some of the obstacles that you discovered that might be helpful for business owners to be aware of?
I think a formalized customer service training is essential at some level because people don't always fully understand necessarily. They might just, you know, say something that they shouldn't be saying to a customer. Customers, mm-hmm. you know, when they're desperate for something, and, you know, today I had a situation where it's a demanding customer. They needed something right away, and the person that fielded the call, the first things out of their mouth was, well, we don't have the truck today. And that's not what the customer wanted to hear or needed to hear.
Right.
So, you know, that's a gap, obviously. We got to, you know, that's a signal. That's, you know, a little area we have to review again. What, you know, what does the customer want to hear or need to hear? There's ways to work things out. It's, you know, the answer probably should have been, well, let me see what I can do to get this to you, and, you know, how much do you need to get you out of a bind type of thing. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, these things happen, and those are signals of, you know, we need to work on this area. You're in the training business, and that's one reason I'm down there training with you from time to time, is for the same reason. I want to sharpen my skills. So I think we all, if we want to, you know, move forward and be successful, have to continually work on sharpening our skills. And uh-huh. I see training as one of the best ways to do that. So,
all right. So that's an important piece of strengthening customer service, is taking a look at what people, what their strengths are, what the obstacles are, and then giving some training on a consistent basis on how to do things in order to maximize that customer, the probability that customer is going to go away feeling like if their problem wasn't solved, they're going to go away feeling like they were heard.
And that's a great thing. People want to know that somebody's listening to them. I mean, have you ever been in a store where the clerk is, like, talking to somebody else while they're checking you out, and you just kind of feel like, oh, gee, who am I? Just, you know, schmaltz or what?
Chopped liver?
Chopped liver. There you go.
Right. All right. So helping people to recognize that what they do and how they do it is they're communicating. Now, when that customer service person is on the phone, they are the company, aren't they?
They're the face of the company. They are it. Yeah. So if they sound like they're just waking up, it's like not a good thing. Or if they sound like they're kicking back, eating pretzels, and sipping a beer or whatever, not a good thing.
Right. Good. All right. So that's one, is a consistent training program. What are other things that were obstacles that you learned about that I don't want to suggest you made mistakes, but what sorts of things did you recover from and learn from?
Thorough contract review. You know, I mentioned that when we brought in the ISO standard, that kind of helped with that. It was trying different methods. You know, again, it's trying to, I think, identify the weakness and then brainstorming of a way of getting, you know, to overcome that. Mm-hmm. And probably most importantly, you know, the people that are doing it themselves have to be a part of that process, because they're versus, you know, management sitting in a different room and deciding what, you know, your customer service team is going to do. Mm-hmm. You know, involving the customer service team and asking them, you know, what do you think we could do to improve the situation?
So having helping them to have a sense of ownership in the whole process, not only the process of customer service, but the process of improving customer service.
Exactly right. Yeah, it's
good.
You know, if they're part of the process and they own part of it, they're a lot more likely to adhere to it and make it happen.
Hmm. Wonderful. Jeff, if somebody wanted to talk to you about, you know, tapes and adhesives, how would they get in touch with you?
MBKtape.com would get them to our website.
Okay.
And they could do a written inquiry, or there's people's phone numbers there to call and talk. And they could surf around our website and see what some of the things are that we do.
Okay.
Now, I don't want to give my phone number off over the air, okay?
Well, that's quite all right. But now you do have a company, you do have a company number on the air that you can give, right?
The company number is, do you want me to give it to you now?
Only if you want to.
It would be 818-998-1477.
One more time?
818-998-1477.
All right. Well, thanks so much, Jeff, for being with us today and sharing, because I know that you're doing such a good job up there in customer service, and I really appreciate you taking the time to tell us how you got there and what you're doing to maintain that that quality system of customer service at MBK.
Well, thank you, Will. It's always a pleasure talking to you.
Good, good. I look forward to talking with you again. Take care.
Okay. You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And there you have it. Wonderful, these wonderful companies in Southern California doing such a good job paying attention to their employees, paying attention to what goes on, focusing on the customer. We've talked about that for 2 years now. Companies grow and thrive because they pay attention to the customer. They pay attention to the customer's needs in terms of sales. They pay attention to the customer's pains, their issues. They find out, salespeople find out where people want to go and how they want to get there, what their budget is, how they make decisions long before they ever start talking about their own products and services, features and benefits, and all of these things that just get in the way of the sales process. And it's not any different for customer service. Before we start talking about how we're going to solve the problem, let's find out exactly what the problem is, how the person has tried to fix it, what kind of experience they have, what they're feeling right now, what their time frame is, what their budget of resources, what kinds of pressures they're feeling. All of those things come long time before we tell them how we're going to fix it. And above all, to make sure that they feel like they are actually heard. Those kind of things that build customer service. And in the kind of economy we're in right now, it's not always a matter of going out and finding a new customer. Sometimes it's a matter of retaining the customers that we have, because remember, our best customers are our competition's best prospects. And one of the major reasons that people leave is not just because of a few pennies in price. It's because they didn't feel they were heard, mistakes were made, nothing was done to change the mistakes or even come back and try to apologize for the mistakes being made. Those things are critical in maintaining our customer base and helping them to develop a loyalty to what we're doing, what we're trying to do for them. So I hope this has been helpful to you as business owners and as CEOs of companies here in Orange County and Southern California as we continue to move forward in this economy and find ways to thrive. So that's what's going on the 405 at this end. Thanks for being with us. I look forward to talking with you again next Wednesday.
You've been listening to the one and only Pilgrim on the 405, only on OCTalkRadio.net.